Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. 2017 marks the centennial of the American entry into the Great War, World War I. This massive four-year conflict took millions of lives around the world. An estimated 17 million people, both military and civilians, died from war and disease during the conflict. While the U.S. stayed out of the war for the first 3 years, a variety of factors converged to change American public opinion. But opinions were still divided in April 1917 when Congress voted to declare war. 56 members of Congress voted against the declaration, and President Woodrow Wilson had just won re-election the previous year with the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." So how to unify the country into a united war effort? As much as anyone, it fell to artists and illustrators, like George Wesley Bellows, who imagined German war atrocities in his war series of lithographs, or James Montgomery Flagg, who created the iconic Uncle Sam, I Want You poster to rouse public opinion to do their civic duty and work for the war effort. Those images are part of the exhibit Hope and Fear, Propaganda of the Great War, which is now on display at Philbrook Museum through November 12th. I'm joined by the two co-curators of the exhibit. Tom Young is the archivist and librarian at Philbrook Museum, and Catherine Whitney is the chief curator at Philbrook. They join me today to talk about this new exhibit at Philbrook. Catherine and Tom, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Tom, it's nice to meet you.
Thank you. Good to meet you.
And Tom, you had a big part of this exhibit, and I know you've been doing a lot of curating at the museum, doing some exhibits from time to time, and this is one of those, Hope and Fear, Propaganda of the Great War. As the librarian of Philbrook, is there a lot of materials about the Great War?
Not really, because the library is not a reference collection. I mean, what we do have would relate to, well, posters, for example, but we don't really have much. We don't really have anything in the way of history and that sort of thing, as a rule. Part of the reason I'm involved is that I have been involved with the Works on Paper collection as sort of unofficial collection manager, but I do have curated exhibitions over the years based on works on paper in the collection.
Yeah. We're commemorating the 100th anniversary of the U.S. entry into the Great War, World War I. This is the first sort of conflict where you see mass-produced propaganda, sort of mass media, but it's in poster format. Right. And this is like the first great era of illustration for propaganda,
right?
Period, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it was certainly influenced by what was going on in Europe, but it was also an issue of, it became a necessity because we had come out of a situation where we had been isolationist. We were trying to stay out of the war, and then we get into the war. And so now you have to kind of backtrack and say why we're getting into the war and, to create support where it hadn't been there before. At least, I don't know what the percentage is of, but, you know, Wilson won by a very small margin. Even one of his big deals was, I've kept you out of the war, and presumably I will continue to do so. He was unable to, though, because of the situation.
Yeah. Now, for artists, this was a period, like, you know, when you think back to the Civil War, it was mainly engravings, and it really wasn't this mass-produced, you know, on every street corner there's a poster reminding you something about the war effort, which we would see later in World War II. But this, the Great War was the first one where you saw this, right?
Right. Yeah, I think, as Tom said, Wilson was really, Woodrow Wilson had campaigned against the war and neutrality, and he really needed to convince the American public that this was a war to become involved in. So the propaganda posters, the imagery, the messaging was vitally important, especially in an age before radio in every home, television, internet. This was a way to kind of spread the word and really influence public opinion.
Yeah. This was also a war in which artists were very much involved. I think of Sargent's great oil paintings of the Great War. In this case, in this exhibit, Hope and Fear, it's Bellows doing a series of lithographs.
Right. There is a major national touring show called World War I in American Art that the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts put together that really looks at American artists' response and witness to the war. I think the difference here with the Bellows lithographs that we have in our collection that are on view in Hope and Fear, Bellows didn't actually witness. He didn't go to war. He didn't see active combat. He volunteered for the tank corps but didn't get called up. So his was really a kind of imagined response to some written propaganda that was a little sensationalized and very well read. So, in fact, his contemporaries kind of criticized him for illustrating these German war atrocities. that had happened in neutral Belgium. And people were saying, how can you do this
if you haven't, haven't
witnessed it? And his quip back was, well, I didn't realize that Da Vinci actually had a ticket to the Last Supper. So he was kind of saying, I'm a great artist. I can respond to these important times and do my part, essentially, because he didn't see active duty. And I think his was more a kind of plea for humanity and against atrocities. And he was responding to the Bryce Report, which was an official British document that was meant to sort of inform the world about what Germans were doing to innocent Belgian citizens who were neutral at the time. And so it was a way to kind of foment outrage.
Now, was this his own response, or was he commissioned to do this?
No, it was his own response.
Okay.
A couple of these he illustrated articles later in 1918, but it was really sort of, he called them his hallucinations. And so he responded to these published accounts that were republished in the New York Times and widely read and, you know, kind of a public outcry. And he really illustrated what he thought were these atrocities in the name of democracy and saying, yes, we need to get involved and save humanity and kind of put these atrocities.
Now, those atrocities happened early in the war, so we're talking 1415.
Right.
Are these from that time, or is this more a response to the American entry into the war?
That's a very good question. In the first published Bryce Report came out in 1915, and he didn't actually do these lithographs until 1918. And I think, you know,
that has to be a response to the war at that point.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, there was the Sedition Act that Woodrow Wilson put out, which basically made it illegal to criticize the United States or the war in any way. And so there was definitely this kind of wave of everybody get in line and everybody do their part. And Bellows originally had been an anti-war activist. And I think when he read these reports, he really kind of got outraged and became somebody who did support the war. But there was a second edition of printed reports by somebody named Bran Whitlock that furthered the statements of German atrocities. And I think he just kind of, you know, for 1 year really focused intently on doing his part and trying to defend innocent victims of the war.
So from an artistic standpoint, how do you view these lithographs
as
a curator?
Yeah, they're kind of strange things. They're very dark and gritty and haunting, and they're lithographs, so they're prints. They're black and white, and they're very dramatic. They're almost done in this grand manner style. They're kind of classical references. They relate to some drawings and some five large paintings that he did on a large scale, and they're beautiful, melodramatic. But the scenes that he's depicting are horrific. So they're this kind of contradictory type of thing. There was one scholar named Carol Troyan who said that they were sort of Bellows' attempt to arouse the best in human behavior by depicting us at our worst. Mm. So there's a lot of contradiction.
You know, it's interesting when you look at a lot of Bellows' work. There's the seacoast views, but when he's in the inner city, it's almost like he would depict people in sort of grotesque ways.
Right.
And sort of, you know, distorted facial features and things like that. Is this sort of a part of this series?
Yeah, it is. He had a history of depicting these very masculine subjects, very kind of violent. And as you said, these inner city kind of gritty scenes. But then on the flip side, he's got these very airy, beautiful, bright scenes of harbor life and kind of vacation land type of thing, you know, showing off his gorgeous paintings. So this was definitely sort of a one-year focus hiatus for him, I think, something that was very personally important to him and national importance to him as well, but just sort of 1 year. And a lot of critics kind of look at this and say, this is not necessarily the best of Bellows. And I think a lot of the criticism was because he got swept up in this propagandistic fury of anti-German sentiment of the time.
So how do you curate a something like that? You know, if you know, when critics say, well, this is not his best work, so how do you curate that in a way in which it sort of explains what the artist was thinking?
First, you have to look at the context and the time period, because it's really what he was doing was responding to his day and the crisis in America and in the world at that time. So I think the way we presented the show as kind of two sides of propaganda, Bellows being sort of the fear side and the posters being
kind aspirational.
Of the side. Yeah, nationalistic. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that cut and dry. It's not that black and white.
Right.
But it's kind of a nice way to divide it, to show that propaganda has many faces. And this was in the context of the time period, the war and propaganda. It's a really great way to show Bellows and to show that he wasn't one-dimensional.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tom, on the other hand, when you look at the illustrations, mm-hmm. And the poster art, this is some of the greatest and most distinctive images in American history. You have a James Montgomery flag, I Want You, Uncle Sam, which, you know, it's interesting. I was looking at the image and I go, I don't remember him looking so fiercely, you know, and I always think of Uncle Sam as having a less stern look, and it's quite stern, the actual original illustration.
It is, and it's so iconic, and which continued for decades. I mean, the Army and the military, I mean, the U.S. government utilized that for enlistment purposes for decades after that. The image, I mean, Uncle Sam dates back to the War of 1812, and so it's had its evolution of what Uncle Sam looks like. And then Flag, of course, has created the one that we all know today.
Yeah, no, I think that's sort of interesting because it's sort mm-hmm. of like, is it NASS that's created the classic image of Santa Claus?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Flag, there's all these images of this Uncle Sam, U.S., that was depicted in political cartoons. Yeah. And yet Flag managed to really create an image that said, okay, this is the standard, really.
And it's in part, it's actually based on an earlier British poster in terms of that same sort of finger pointing out at you and saying, you know, in essence, I want you to enlist. So, I mean, that sort of format that he uses, there is a predecessor to it. But Uncle Sam is also, there's another poster of Uncle Sam by another artist who is even more ferocious in terms of, I kind of call him the evil one because he kind of is looking at you like with squinty eyes almost. But
like the mean teacher.
The mean one, yeah.
but
you're right, this Uncle Sam does. He's very forceful.
Yeah, but getting back to this era, this was like the golden age of illustration, really.
And the reality is the majority of the artists who were working in this were not illustrators, but Flagg and Christie and Leyendecker and Gibson. They were illustrators who had experience in doing that. Most others, like Bellows and others, were artists who then participated in it. And there's sometimes some discussion about, well, did they really do, the best job of illustrating a poster, you know, creating an image? It was successful, however we want to translate it today.
Yeah, I was just thinking about this general age. You know, you had, you know, all of a sudden magazines are paying good money for really good color illustrations. So they're beginning to put color illustrations in their and so this was a golden age,
it
really.
Was. Starting in the late 1890s, I think.
Yeah.
I think Flagg was probably the best paid illustrator of the day.
Yeah.
He Collier's and Harper's Weekly all those serial magazines.
I think he had started out with Life, I believe, and then Collier wanted him to be exclusively working for them. But he said, well, I can't give up Life because they got me started. And so he did work with both primarily, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about some of the images. The other images we'll see. You see the Uncle Sam. There's a very aspirational-looking Howard Chandler Christie, I think. It sort of appeals to the best nature of Americans to pitch in and be a part of the war effort.
Gosh, there's a variety, although it's limited by its limitations, of course. We leave so much out, unfortunately. But probably the most unique of the group is talking about conserving food. Eat less so that we can send food to both the front for the soldiers, but also for all of the hundreds of thousands or millions of refugees from Belgium and France and even Italy and other parts of the world. So, you know, they'd have meatless day and wheatless day and even cornless day or something anyway. And this one poster, it's focusing on eat fish.
And then the very kind of allegorical figures of Colombia, of the woman as, you know, the representation of America and strength and beauty in the Christie girl. And I see there's a little bit of that kind of allegorical echoing also in the Bellows, because you have these almost very classical figures of mourning. It's a different, very different feeling, but you use almost these allegorical figures to represent these abstract concepts.
And I think that's a big key to propaganda, is sort of creating this connection to help you sort of form your opinion.
Right.
The point was made on many occasions that the image itself, you know, not everybody can read. Or maybe you're walking down the street and you see a poster, at least you get the gist of the sensibility of it. Now, I think it probably helps to read it, but even though they're very terse sorts of captions and so forth or titles. The other thing, too, is at this time, the United States in 1917 has the population is about 30% of the population are either immigrant or first generation. And there is a real fear by the government in terms of are those German Americans going to support us, or are they going to be agents for
Do we trust our population, right, really, is right. what it comes down to.
And you'll see in a number of posters, and I can't remember if it's the one on display now or not, but are you 100% American? And if so, you're going to buy that Liberty Bond, and you're going to buy the next Liberty Bond drive and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm. Or even the one of the Christie girl who's mm-hmm. sort of pointing at the wall of donors, if you will, and all mm-hmm. the names are
you call this a Christie girl. This is sort of this stylized American,
yes.
really.
Yes.
I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's almost like
Gibson girl. But
yeah, right.
Well, the Gibson girl comes earlier on, and then Christie creates something similar sensibility, maybe a little bit later in time, too, stylistically.
And isn't it like a Lady Liberty sort
yes,
of figure?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like Columbia.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, it comes out of their illustration work. Mm-hmm. This is the image, just like Lydekker, who's the Arrow Man, you know. There was that would be, it was iconic in a sense. You'd see it in advertisements or even in illustration and stories in the magazines and so forth that they mm-hmm. all worked in.
Yep. So very familiar imagery, very mm-hmm. emotional imagery. Yeah. And I think the point of the show is very much how propaganda and messaging really taps mm-hmm. the audience's emotion in order to kind of mobilize them.
And I think what's really interesting about seeing illustration is there's a whole variety of styles. When you look at, say, Flags, Uncle Sam, yes, I Want You, it's a very simple, direct image. Right. But when you look at, like, Christie's work, it's like he's creating this really, beautiful, artsy image mm-hmm. in which you really have to look at it to really understand right. the message.
But it does inspire
yeah.
patriotism.
Right,
that's the surface. That's the first hit, mm-hmm. Pride and mm-hmm. and pride of country. And then there are all these layers, as you said, these kind of allegorical layers and beautiful flowing layers.
Right. And, of course, you alluded to one of the other big efforts during the war was to finance it. And
yes.
it was through war bonds. And that was a big effort in which illustration, not only in World War I, but also in World War II, this was a big area of emphasis.
Yeah, when the war is declared, how do we fund this? And do we do it by taxation? And I think I maybe
remember
I'm wrong,
the income tax was only around for a few years. It's only been about 4 or 5 years at that point. Yeah,
and so there's a fear that if you really start raising income tax, is this going to cause a backlash in terms of support for the war? And so even though the income tax does get raised, the Liberty Bond and the sale of the Liberty Bond really becomes a major funding source for it. Now, the public, your citizens, are loaning you money. You have to pay it back with interest, although interest is lower than you could have got if you'd gone in other ways, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that you'll be patriotic, you will do this. And there were 5 Liberty Bond drives starting in, 1917 and then continuing after the war in 1919. Mm-hmm. Because just because the war was over did not mean that there wasn't a cost. There were soldiers who remained in Europe until they were along the Rhine and so forth, along with the French and the British and so forth, to make sure that the Germans didn't rise up until everything was set, because it was a pretty harsh treaty. But it was important to involve the larger population in by buying bonds to support this effort.
Yeah. My guests today are Tom Young, the librarian for Philbrook, and Catherine Whitney, the chief curator of Philbrook. They've collaborated on a new exhibit, which is running at Philbrook through November 12th, Hope and Fear, Propaganda of the Great War, which includes the war series of lithographs by George Wesley Bellows, as well as a collection of illustrative art, a propaganda of America's entry into the World War I, which was 100 years ago this year. And they're my guests today on Studio Tulsa. Well, as you look at this material, I mean, for long times, you would never see posters at a museum. That's become a relative, it's in the last decade or couple of decades where this sort of art is being celebrated.
Yeah, I think it's social history. So, and it is artistic if you look back at it. And is this the first time, Tom, we've shown these posters that we received in 1942?
As far as I know, it's the first, whether they were displayed at the time of acquisition in the early 40s, I don't know.
The first time in a while, anyway.
It was certainly the first time,
and
I think.
And a great
since that time that they have been up.
And great occasion. Yeah. But I think, as I said, it's also extremely relevant not only because the 100-year anniversary of the war, but because everything that's going on now. I mean, with fake news. I mean, propaganda is some of it's right, some of it's exaggerated and sensationalized. It's very relevant right now. And I think, you know, with all the posters and the marches and, you know, the very divisive nature of where we are right now in politics, I think it's a really extremely relevant and fun show to revisit and see that things haven't changed that much in 100 years.
Are there some illustrations where it's like, it's just ridiculous? I mean, in a way, in its depiction? I mean, sometimes when you look back at propaganda, it's like, oh my God, could anybody believe something like this?
It can be overblown. I mean, there is one of the Christie girl, and she's standing over on the right side, and then you see these sailors on a ship with the cannon shooting off in the distance, and there is the connection is pretty weak, I think, but I guess they're defending Colombia. I don't know.
I think with Bellows too, I mean, he was criticized because some of his images were so extreme and so intense and maybe caught up in these exaggerated reports, some of which were found to be true and some were sensationalized. But I think there was this potential that people believed that the Germans were capable of this. So, again, you kind of have to look at the context of the time period, and I think that's what makes it so relevant. And, you know, history is always educational, and we need to catch ourselves when there's so much going on in the news today, and people will look back and say, how did people believe that? But we are victims of our own times, I think.
I would think this would be an interesting show to curate, to sort of put all of these different items in context. Right. Has it been an interesting experience?
It has been. We had a lot of really great discussions. At Philbrook, we tend to do shows now almost with whole interpretive committees, which has been a really enriching experience because we bring different departments to all of our planning meetings and get different perspectives from communications, from education, from curatorial. And so it's really a museum-wide effort, and our director sits in on almost all of them. And we have really rich discussions about what are we trying to do, what's important, what's the takeaway, how can we engage audiences, what's meaningful and what's interesting. Not just, oh, let's look at this from a art historical perspective as if, you know, I were one scholar writing for five other scholars who specialize in this particular field around the country. So what is going to be the takeaway? And those have been really
did you get a wide variety of opinions on this?
We really tried to craft our kind of big message here, which is that during turbulent times that propaganda can be very emotional. It can really inspire people in the name of national politics, essentially. And so
it has to be emotional.
You have two very different takes on, you know, Bellows was inspired by sensationalized propaganda, and Tom's was more kind of public art that was meant to inspire action and enlistment and conservation of food and helping the troops. So they're different sides of the same face, but so that was kind of tricky to knit those together, and so we decided on the hope and fear to show the two different sides. And as I said, it's not that black and white, but it's kind of a fun thing, and our graphic designer did a great job, you know, doing elevator graphics pointing up and you point up to fear and down to hope, which is also a little turning things upside down.
And so you have this on two levels of the museum
sort of a split presentation, but a unified theme.
All right, well, it's on display through November 12th. Hope and Fear, Propaganda of the Great War, on display at Philbrook. Tom, Catherine, thanks very much for joining
us.
Thank you.
Catherine Whitney is the chief curator at Philbrook Museum of Art. Tom Young is the librarian there, and they're both curators of the exhibit Hope and Fear, Propaganda of the Great War, which commemorates the 100th anniversary of the United States' entry into World War I. It's currently on display at Philbrook Museum of Art through November 12th. Information at philbrook.org. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
Iceland, Part 1. At the airport in Reykjavik, there's a mural with the words, "Better weight than wisdom a traveler cannot carry." Yeah, me neither. I have no idea what that means. To have been there, though, when it happened. This from a report. As protesters streamed onto the streets, into their thousands, on one occasion throwing snowballs, eggs, and yogurt at the parliament, the role of special prosecutor was created to look into rumors of epic financial wrongdoing, close quote. This was Iceland in 2008, before the country's three largest banks fell in the space of 3 days, before the currency collapsed, before the stock market fell 95%, and before nearly every business in the country went bankrupt. The country then did something unusual. It didn't cut social services. In fact, it raised taxes, offered debt relief to the country's mortgage holders, and then the country jailed some bankers. They threw food, the Icelanders did, then raised taxes, increased social services, and found in the process their better angels. We didn't do that here in America. We blame the victims. Now, remember Rick Santelli, the man often credited with igniting the Tea Party movement back in February of 2009? Santelli, reporting from the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, this was on CNBC, called people in the process of foreclosing homes, people who were losing their homes, he called them losers, and said government would be promoting bad behavior by helping them by bailing them out. Investors and traders who heard Santelli cheered. Listen to that again. They cheered. Now, this was written at the time about the dynamic in our country. This is by Mike Collins of Forbes magazine. The operating principles of the big banks is a cesspool of greed, ethics, and criminal intent, and they give a very bad name to free market capitalism. During the housing bubble, Wall Street was considered the heart and soul of free market capitalism. But when they were in danger of total collapse, they fell on their knees as socialists, begging the government and taxpayers to bail them out. Closed quote. And we did. As things improved in America, in large measure due to the stimulus package against which many of these captains of industry criticized after, of course, slurping all the milk from the government teat, they became unbridled capitalists, again telling us regulations were too tough and American exceptionalism hung in the balance. Soon, they got the legislators they wanted. Donald Trump became president, and Dodd-Frank, designed to prevent such economic calamities, was defanged. We decided our better angels were the ones who caused all the problems, caused all the damage. Honey, I said to Melissa last November, Iceland just jailed its bankers. What did we do here, she asked. We apologized for burdening them. Let's move. Let's go visit. Yeah, right. Now, Melissa turned 40 last December. I had the birthday boots she wanted in the cart on Amazon. Nice boots, expensive boots, boots worthy of a 40th birthday present. But they were in Iceland. Boots don't get you tears in a downtown restaurant over a birthday steak. So we bought flannel, and we're going to Iceland.
Barry Friedman is a writer and essayist and a columnist for the Tulsa Voice and a regular contributor for us here at Studio Tulsa. That's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.